Hello, friends. Welcome once again to the Perfect Bound Podcast. This is a podcast all about anything and everything comic books and comics related, brought to you by the Panel Jumper and Comic Extension. My name is Ben. With me, as always, is Cole Hornaday.
Hey there.
Nicole Lamb.
Hello.
And Chris Gasso.
Hi.
How are all y'all this evening?
Okay.
Doing okie dokie.
All right. I'm doing just great, too. It's the final show that we're recording tonight. I'm getting kind of warm. I can't wait to go home and relax in front of my computer and upload all of this information. There you go.
Do you ever put your feet in like a pan of cool water? Do you ever do that?
I don't do that. Well, I don't have a pan.
Well, there's where you fail.
I know. Well, I could just put it. I have a tub is having an issue draining.
Long,
I could just
spindly legs. You could like just like you know. Put your feet in the
He's flailing. Oh,
yeah,
so hard
put your
right
feet
now.
In the sink in the kitchen, and scooch your laptop over to the counter, and you could be cool.
And you could die that way by electrocution.
Hey. Anyway, when I lived in the Midwest and it would be so hot and muggy, that's what we'd do. Put some ice in a pot, put our feet in cold water, and it helped a lot because none of the buildings that we lived in had air conditioning. That was
My building gets really hot because there's no air conditioning and the sun beats through my southwest facing windows almost all day. I have a few hours reprieve while it goes behind the giant skyscraper they built across the street. Anyway, let's get on with the show, shall we? And one of the things we have to do here at the Perfect Bound Podcast is
Shout out.
Yes. There's a word that I'm looking for, and it's not coming to me, but as we are
recognized,
honor bound to observe some names of people who are Patreon supporters of us. There are different levels of support. You can find those levels at patreon.com/thepaneljumper. I think that's it. And at a certain level, and it'll be on the show.
Yeah.
At a certain level, just click the link below this, whatever you're listening to. A certain level, at the highest level, you can actually get your name in the... Oh, no, highest level, Cole and I will have the audience applaud you at Panel Jumper Live, which we just did about a month ago now. The second highest level, you get that... you get your... name in the credits of a Panel Jumper episode that you support, and the level below that is we just say your name here on the podcast, and then the level before that you just get our everlasting.
We got to come up with some type of tangible treats for folks.
Yeah, I don't want to start mailing stuff because then we're gonna be like, oh, I gotta mail that thing. It's gonna cost
money.
We
have so few Patreon supporters as it is that you know.
I don't think getting a tchotchke is gonna. Anyway, we could. This will be an offline discussion.
Do you want a tchotchke for being a supporter?
All right.
Would you feel more inspired to be a supporter if you could get a tchotchke?
Well, actually, we should be having a meeting with our new marketing maven, Webster, to talk about how to handle all this stuff. Because I'm not a marketer. I don't know how to do any of these things. But I do know how to follow the rules. And one of the rules is I'm going to say your name here in the podcast, even though you're probably not, you are listening. And congratulations and thank you for supporting our show. So I want to give a shout out. This is all one long-winded thing. That I think I'm getting the heat's coming, getting to my head. You know what I'm saying? Right. And I'm wearing these headphones.
Are you drinking your water?
I am drinking my water. I'm almost done. Anyway, so this is my Patreon shout out to you, those who support us at a certain level on patreon.com. We want to thank Daniel Christensen, Mark Brewster, Nick Rykar, Webster Polk, Brian Howard, Jessamine Bateman Iano. And I said that as a question because I'm looking at Cole and he nodded his head. I said that correctly. Stephen McCandless, Lauren Dudley, and manager Mike Gilson. And we did have a new Patreon supporter at this level, Jeff and Samara Alman, who joined after the latest Panel Jumper live episode. They joined.
Oh, thank you, Jeff and Samara.
Yeah, thank you, Jeff and Samara.
They are big supporters of ours.
We like them. And oddly enough, I don't know all the names on this list. Go figure.
That's all right.
So you said we're honor bound for that. Do we have a blood bound level and a soul bound level? Can we have those?
All right.
And do they come with tchotchkes?
Let's talk about that after Cole tells us about one of his personal heroes. Recently, Mr. Right. Harlan Ellison has passed
so
away.
So about a month ago now, Harlan Ellison, writer of speculative fiction and things, passed away at the age of 84. So I'm going to read you some things that I wrote because it's late in the evening and my articulators go south after a certain hour of the evening.
You mean I could have just written all this
you
down?
You could have written it all down, brother. So let's get something straight. Harlan Ellison was a brash, nasty, emotionally, physically violent misogynist, and he was, for a greater part of my life, my favorite writer. I think I quit reading him on the regular once I started graduate school. I told myself I'd grown out of his anger, petulance, self-loathing that had fueled his my interest in his works and didn't need his voice much anymore. And that all changed about halfway through my master's degree. Ellison has been everywhere at one time. He wrote for television. He wrote short stories. He wrote essays relating to media and how it impacts social consciousness. And he wrote comics. But the thing about his comics is that where the superhero comics are concerned, he plotted many stories and was credited for writing them. But other people actually took them over. There's a very famous, incredible Hulk story from Hulk 140. We'll get to a little bit later, that sort of set the trend of a lot of these kinds of stories. He wrote an Avengers story. He wrote in the 80s, he wrote probably one of the more impactful Daredevil stories that was not written by Frank Miller. But he always co-wrote them with someone else, so you never were entirely certain if he penned them himself or just threw the ideas on the table and let someone else put it together. But yeah, he in this age of hashtag Me Too and at a phase in my life where the universe is taking back my heroes, I've been going through a lot of personal reconciliation or at least exploration of what these people were like, why they impacted me with their work, and should I really be trying to like compartmentalize their nasty nature, their cruelty, versus their work. You know, we had a really, I thought, profitable, healthy discussion about H.P. Lovecraft a couple of years ago where Nicole just said, I will never read any of his work because, and I had to sit there and go, you know, I'm a privileged white guy and 10, 20 years ago, I would have looked down my nose at Nicole and now I'm listening to her going, I get why you don't want to read this stuff. And in reading some of this, sharing some of this stuff with you, there's no reason why you should read Harlan Ellison because he was an hole. And you can blip me or you can leave it, but he was nice person. But I'm not the only person that's been struggling to deal with his impact on popular consciousness and him as a person. There's a great obit in the New York Times. And the author said, in general, Ellison is a writer whose readership leans heavily on people who read him as a teen and often outgrew him. As Tim Holder of the Comics Journal noted, Ellison was, quote, was a perfect writer to discover in middle school or junior high. And that's exactly when I discovered one of his short story collections. And he was a very prolific short story writer. And that's what he was good at. In his lifetime, he wrote at least 1,700 short stories and articles and at least 100 books and dozens of screenplays and television scripts. Now, hopefully you know some of his television scripts. Probably one of the more famous is the classic Star Trek episode featuring Joan Collins called The City on the Edge of Forever, mm-hmm. Where they get bounced back in time to the 1940s, and Spock has this great line about, you know, trying to use the technology of the times and essentially working with bearskins and knives. But the truth be told, that script that was known as one of the best episodes ever written was heavily doctored by Roddenberry, and Ellison resented that for the entirety of his career and always said nasty things about Star Trek going forward.
Did Harlan Ellison keep his name on the episode?
He did keep his name on the episode, but you can buy, he had later published, you know, the complete script, and they also, I think IDW did a comic book adaptation of it. And when you read it, his original teleplay, it's like a 2-hour-long episode, and it's essentially unshootable for 1964 or 5 or whenever they were shooting the TV series.
That probably would have been about 67?
Okay. All right. Cory Doctorow, who's a science fiction writer and I guess roughly my age, said in a recent piece he wrote for Boing Boing, confronting the very real foibles of the object of my hero worship was the beginning of a very important long-running lesson whose curriculum I'm still working through. The ability to separate artists from art and the ability to understand the sins of people who've done wonderful things. And I think that puts my perspective on Ellison's work pretty well. When I was muttering a couple weeks ago that, you know, one of my favorite writers had died, a couple friends said, well, what are your favorite stories? And I realized I could tell you the name of the story and the story, you know, verbatim. And I can't do that with a lot of things. And those were not necessarily stories that I read more than once. I bet you a nickel I read most of them just once. Hmm. But they had that kind of impact on me. Hmm. Let's see. But he was incredibly eloquent, and I think that's one of the most infuriating things about this guy. He said, I don't know how you perceive my mission as a writer, but for me, it is not a responsibility to reaffirm your concretized myths and provincial prejudices. It is not my job to lull you with a false sense of the rightness of the universe, the wonderful and the terrible this wonderful and terrible occupation of recreating the world in a different way, each time fresh and strange, is an act of revolutionary guerrilla warfare. I stir the soup. I inconvenience you. I make your nose run and your eyeballs water. And he did that very, very well. But there was that strain of adolescent anger that ran through all of his stories. And that was probably one of the biggest criticisms people had of his work. It's like, he knew rage. He could put rage into poetry incredibly successfully, but he could not tell stories with characters of any nuance, of any delicacy, delicate nature, of any fragile emotion. It was big and it was bold and it was loud. In 1995, he started publishing through Dark Horse. It started out monthly, which to me at the time I thought was kind of ambitious, but it was a monthly comic book adapting his short stories called Dream Corridor. And then Ellison had his first heart attack, which landed him in a hospital and laid him up for a while. Now, the guy was also known for being a severe procrastinator. I mean, just go ahead and look up the stories of him editing the Dangerous Visions anthology and how he sat on one of those collections for over 20 years, and people wrote stories about what became of the stories. His anthology that had never seen the light of day became mythic in and of itself. But my favorite... And talk to anybody who did the sci-fi or the comic book circuit, convention circuit back in the 70s and the 80s. Every one of these people will have a Harlan Ellison story. My friends have personal Harlan Ellison stories. Not many of them good, but all of them amusing. Hmm. Gene Haw in particular drew a story for Ellison's Dream Corridor called The Silver... Oh, darn it. Now I can't remember it. When Ellison was struck ill, everything went into limbo, and I remember seeing Gene's original artwork for this and wondering if it'll ever see the light of day, and none of us knew that it was called The Silver Corridor. It was adapted by Mark Waid. And finally it did in a big collected edition. And that's what wound up happening with Dream Corridor, is that they couldn't do the monthly comic, then it went quarterly, then it was specials, and then it just finally wound up being two big trade paperback collections. Mm. It was not a good tribute to him in comics. It's unfortunate that not more was done with it. It was a wonderful collection of different people interpreting his work, but he kind of, my understanding is that he kind of ruled over it with an iron fist as far as how it was going to be put together. I did enjoy that quite a bit. I like seeing different artists' interpretation of his work. So lastly, what else did I want to say? Does anybody have, it sounds like nobody here is really familiar with his work.
I'm familiar with him as a person, but I've never sat down and read through any of his stuff. They just never, mm-hmm. never appealed to me, and nobody ever told me, hey, you should do this. Mm-hmm. And still nobody ever has. So okay. I'm just kind of like, yeah, I don't know.
And at this point, because I've said such nasty things about him, I don't know if I've really inspired anybody who has not already read him to do so. There are some really fascinating stories. One of his stories that I love is called Shatter Day, and it's this guy gets this phone call, and he finds out he's getting this phone call from his doppelganger, and the doppelganger says, hey, buddy, you need to get your life together, or I'm going to take it over. And the thing is, the doppelganger is better at being him than he is. He goes out and does nice things for his mother, takes his girlfriend to restaurants. He does a good job at being the guy that the real guy cannot be, and eventually he takes over. And I really like that story. It's like, yeah, you know, do well with your life, do good with the time you had, because someone else could come and take over. But my favorite story is a more recent one called Angry Candy, and it's about this, excuse me, it's from the collection Angry Candy. The story is called Laugh Track, and it's about a guy who's he writes sitcoms, and he had this beloved aunt named Aunt Babe, and for years he swore he could hear Aunt Babe on the laugh tracks of sitcoms, and she recorded these studio audience recordings back in the 50s, but he swears he can hear her voice deteriorating as this laugh track is repeated and repeated and repeated over crummier and crummier and crummier sitcoms. So he finds this sweetener, this guy who can extract Aunt Babe's laughter from all these bajillion soundtracks, and he puts her in a box because he feels like her soul is trapped in there, and this is how he can save her. Well, in this collecting of all these vocal tracks, her essence is there, and she talks to him through the little black box where she's contained, and she basically says, it's time for you to let me go. So he can write these stories that had a profound impact on me. And I said he could write, he was indelicate, but there was always that rage, that angry candy in all of his stories. Let's see. I'm gonna just wrap it up with this quote from Isaac Asimov, who I just think is a pompous ass, but still knows what he's talking about. Asimov observed, "It is simply terrible that he, Ellison, should be constantly embroiled in matters which really have nothing to do with his writing and which slow him down tragically." And Asimov wrote in 1994, and he added, he claims he's 5'4" tall, but it doesn't really matter. In talent, energy, and courage, he is 8 feet tall. And that's probably a good way to remember this guy, who was just a bottle of rage but was bigger on the inside.
It does. It is striking that you can relate to the whole, like, the jerk who does good work, mm-hmm. right? I don't want to like you,
yeah,
because I don't like you, but I like what you do. I did see this interview with Harlan Ellison on YouTube where he was talking. It was all about getting paid for creative work,
right?
Which I am all in favor of. But the way he talked about it was, he described this story of this, like, assistant director or PA calling him, like, asking for permission to use something that he'd done in, like, a TV show or a movie. And she was probably told by the producer, by the director, just call Harlan, get his permission. And he describes telling off this poor PA, mm-hmm. this poor assistant director, and it's probably not their fault. Mm-hmm. He describes her as this young lady, you know, and I'm like, this poor girl is just right. have to sit there on the phone being
she gets railed on.
Yeah, by Harlan Ellison, and it's just doing her job. So I'm watching, because I don't know Harlan Ellison. I haven't knowingly read his work. I forgot that didn't even know that he wrote that episode of Star Trek. That's mm-hmm. that's a really good episode. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I watched that because trying to get a little sense of the guy. I'm like, wow, I would not like you.
No, no. And he was incredibly litigious. I mean, on the one side, reading his essays about how he protected his intellectual properties was inspiring, but I would like to believe I'm still enough a person, an artist with enough empathy for others,
yeah.
that I would not tear a hole in someone who, you know, stepped over that imaginary boundary.
Yeah.
But I'll go into some of that in the quiz time I have for y'all, because I know you're just, you know, you're just waiting for that.
So are there any Ellison written comics that one should check out, even if they are interested, or if they are interested in the man's writing?
Sure. I think a great entry is getting your hands on the Harlan Ellison's Dream Quarter from Dark Horse. There are two collected editions. Don't bother buying the single issues that feature illustrated versions of adaptations of his short stories. But then there's also framing sequences that he wrote that are drawn by Eric Schanauer. He also, in every issue of the, oh, well, let me, I'm going to take it back. I forgot. In every issue of the single standalone, every issue of the
of the monthly.
Thank
monthly
you.
Singles. Yeah. Yeah.
He had an original short piece he wrote. So, and ooh. I don't think, and flipping through this I don't think they're all included in there. So that's one. There's also a kind of a cool collection of Hulk stories called Heart of the Atom that was put out. It's a Marvel Premiere classic that was put out. Oh, Chris, remember when this was? A
couple years ago. I don't remember.
It's got the individual copyrights of the comics, but it doesn't say the book.
I don't know if those are still in print.
Most of them aren't in print, so... Yeah.
Might be like library. Try to find it on library.
Yeah.
Maybe it's on Marvel Unlimited or something.
Looks like it was printed in 2008. This collection I'm holding was from 2008.
Gotcha.
And, you know, he plotted the first couple of these stories that involve Hulk going to the Microverse. But then, you know, the rest of it is all other regular Marvel contributors.
The Vertigo one, was it something 7?
Yeah, that... Yeah, the one he did with Paul Chadwick is called, and I have it here in my notes. In 2013 he did a graphic novel called 7 Against Chaos with Paul Chadwick, you know, creator
That's
of
the
Concrete.
Last relevant printed one that I remember, and I talked to a few people who were just kind of like, meh.
Yeah, it was boring.
Okay.
Yep, so, I didn't care for it at all.
Got it.
I was really disappointed because Paul Chadwick, you know, I'm a big fan.
It should have been a double twofer.
Right, and it just wasn't. It was lackluster, and it didn't go anywhere. Mm. And it felt like, if anything, it was sort of like a Bible for an ongoing series. Because he did do that. He would set up templates. So he had a series of books called Harlan's World, where he's, you know, and he would set up the Bible for a universe and invite other writers to play there.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Cool.
Any final words on Harlan Ellison before we move on to Book Report? I'm sure we're going to learn some more in the quiz time.
Yes, you're going to learn more in the quiz time. I think I did all the rattling that I needed to rattle off.
All right. Okay. Well, let's move on to Book Report, everybody. And thank you, Cole.
Sure.
And, we're going to move on to part 4 of our all-inclusive Preacher special. This is where all of us are reading, or in everybody's case but mine, rereading Preacher. I am reading it for the first time. And we're getting this train back on rails because the books have been reprinted in so many different versions. Mm-hmm. I had a hard time figuring out what story arc was next. So last time when we did this, we kind of overlapped on two different story arcs. So the last time was the Hunter's arc, which includes the sex club imagery. So this one is the Proud American story arc, which begins with the Vietnam flashback and moves on through
Masada
mm-hmm. and ends with them rescuing Cassidy and him talking about how he came to be
his
vampire.
Flashbacks. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Garth Ennis loves war stuff, and knowing that now, rereading it is interesting because I didn't know any of that when I first read Preacher. This was my introduction to Garth Ennis. Mm-hmm. So now reading it is like, of course he's got to have an obligatory war story, you know.
Well, specifically Vietnam, because that's his jam.
Yes, that's true.
But also Irish history.
Yep, exactly. And then
which I'll say is one of the only ways I've ever been exposed to it.
It's true.
And then I kind of looked up some more, and I'm like, oh, you do love your history. This is kind of accurate settings and everything.
I'm kind of assuming, based on that his name is Garth Ennis, that he's Irish.
I thought he was Irish.
Yeah, I thought he was too.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, because Miller Irish is Scottish, I think.
Yep.
And Millar.
I think it's Miller.
I don't know. Doesn't matter.
All right. Are you talking about Mark?
It's Garth Ennis. And, So what I really appreciate about Steve Dillon's artwork is that specifically in the Vietnam flashback, that Custer's dad doesn't look like it looks like Custer, but looks like Custer's dad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm always amazed at the nuances that artists can put into these, because I can't draw worth anything. And so I'm kind of amazed that, this guy can draw somebody's dad, make it look like their dad. He's got features. Mm-hmm. Of his son, but it's obviously not the same character he's drawing from.
And some of it's just subtleties of some slightly different face lines.
Yeah,
pretty much. Know? Yeah,
and
So did Ennis, or excuse me, did Dillon draw the boys?
No, that's okay. Derek Roberts.
Okay, never mind.
Mm-hmm. So the I always love the because I think I already talked about the Masada sequence, because like you said, we were all out of whack, and I was like, way out of whack, because I went crazy on the previous one.
Right.
So I kind of already chatted about that. So I focused more on the Cassidy sequence on this one.
Yeah.
And I remember reading this when I was really young, and the entire sequence where his brother and him are just having a conversation as they escape certain death, and the brother basically giving the speech about watch out for people with causes. And stuff like that actually like set a early foundation for the way I viewed things, you know, that led me to like Bill Hicks and a bunch of other stuff, which, by the way, Bill Hicks is mentioned in Preacher as well.
Yeah. So it's in just, Dixie Fried, when we get to the, yeah, we'll the get next to arc. Yeah.
Really? Well, I can't wait, because Hicks is one of my favorites.
Yeah. But, you know, that's foreshadowing that too for Cassidy getting involved
With a cause.
Yes.
Yeah.
With Jesse's quest. And he says to, you know, I don't remember if he says it in this story arc, but, you know, I think it's after Jesse rescues him from Cassie from Masada. He says, you know, I'm committed to this quest until it's done.
That was this one.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yep. All right.
That's Cassidy's a great, great character, and this is one of the things that set him up for me really well. And also, the pacing change is something I love of Garth Ennis and long runs like this, because the whole Masada stuff is pretty hardcore. There's a lot of constant action, violent death.
It's pretty nonstop.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But the being able to tell a story with a constant flashback that comes back to the framing sequence pretty consistently... it had a very relaxed pace to it.
Yeah.
Even if there was violence in the flashback, it still felt nice and relaxed and a nice come down from the last story.
It felt not of the last story.
Yes.
It felt like the Christmas special, to the previous season. And one of the things, like, Cassidy's real name is
Proinsis.
I was pronouncing it Proinsis, and I was just because I was thinking it like his brother was just saying princess, calling him princess, but in like an Irish brogue. But then he says later on, it's an
actual Gaelic name. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We're gonna have to Google that. And
yeah, because Gaelic is a very strange sounding language.
Proinsis.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Did anybody get anything new on this latest rereading of the whole Masada sequence that we may not have mentioned last time?
I can't remember just what that, we mentioned
that,
last
the,
time.
The bitter hatred for organized religion is so amazing. That, you know, there's he makes you regret putting faith in anything higher than yourself.
Or your friends. Yeah, yeah.
Just the representation of the order in this behemoth, bulimic all-father character who's prodigiously vomiting all over everyone, and then, you know, the male representative of the bloodline of the Christ, you know, flinging its feces everywhere.
And like Hairstar becomes kind of like a good guy in this, because he's just like, this is like such sort of like
he's looking out for number one,
but it's good by comparison.
But it's in context only. But it's just like, this is ridiculous. What are we doing? You know.
And just all the characters, even the more the second tier, third tier supporting characters, like the hitman, the eunuch hitman.
Yeah, like they spend time with him.
You know, with his Enfila or whatever the European rifle is. And you hear this guy's story, and it's Tarantino-esque rambling at a certain point. Because
but way
like,
better than that.
Yeah, but because, and I'm sorry, I guess I'm going to inevitably compare some of the patter in Preacher to Tarantino because I can't think of anybody else who does that with these characters where you get these where they monologue and you learn things about them that may or may not be immediately pertinent to what's happening in the story. You know, was that a cul-de-sac? You know, do we need to learn that? Or was it a texture on the bigger a texture being laid into the bigger pattern a tapestry is being woven.
Yeah. Why not both? Because he does cul-de-sac quite a bit in his large works. So something of interest, because I just scanned everybody's copies here. so I'm reading the Giant Monster Death version. Cut off the circulation to your legs if you hold it.
Yes.
And
is that everything in one volume?
It's 1 through 26 one giant hardcover. That's about this. I'm doing hand things with radio.
Does it creak when you open it?
It does.
It screams a little bit.
It's like the Neverending Storybook.
Yes. It reprints letter pages because the first few issues before this was before message boards became popular, and because it's 93, 94, something like that, and so he puts those in there, and like the very first letters page, because there are no letters, is him basically being, God, he must have been mid-20s at the point, just full of piss and vinegar, and basically saying how much they just want to be as insulting as they can, but with actual content, and basically wanting to be trying to piss off both the conservatives and the liberals as much as he can. And it was like, oh, this explains so much now. It has some of that anger feeling that Harlan Ellison, that you mentioned with Harlan Ellison, but it's also kind of more to a point of just doing it for
the sheer joy,
poops and giggles.
Yeah, the sadistic joy of doing it because you can.
Yes,
which is the way I feel about Tarantino.
Yeah, and
you didn't have to do that, but you did because you could.
And in the letter pages, he compares himself to Tarantino in Pulp Fiction because that just come out at that time. So that's the letter pages are very interesting to listen to because he gets so just kind of snarky with all the people sending stuff in, but they're snarky to him as well. And then basically with all his works, everybody he works with is they're kind of the boys there, and he has like a little story for each of them and how they're all degenerates. And it's a very consistent, don't kill him. Sorry, there's a fly here. I'm going to protect him. And,
it's going to crawl up in your nose and breed. You know that, right?
It's just a fruit fly.
But yeah, so anyway, the letters pages are a fascinating add-on to the series, and I do recommend reading them.
Can those be found in anywhere other than these the circulation-crushing hardbound copies?
Well, the back issues, but now number one is so crazy price.
What does it go for now?
$100 or so.
At least.
$150.
Wow. That's amazing.
I bet you that there's somebody who scanned them online.
Okay.
It has to be, you know. So they're worth reading just because it gives you context to the character of Garth Ennis at the time. Because the opening introduction is from 2016, and he sounds like an older man who's just being like, boy, those were the days when he didn't give a crap, and it was like the Wild West. And
meanwhile, he's like in his late 30s or something.
He's got to be almost hitting his late 40s or early 50s now. And yeah, like one of the early letter pages is just like, you know, I'm just catching up to great works like Saga and Bone and Cerebus. I'm like, this is timing me right now.
Buckle up.
Yeah, I know. So yeah.
One thing I thought was interesting, and I'm sure we're going to see it in the next, you know, coming up, is that Tulip doesn't reappear in New York at the end of this volume.
Mm-hmm. That's, well, no, there's time for that stuff to happen.
I'm sure there's plenty of time. I just found that odd that we didn't see that, her wrath, because the last time we saw her, she had basically gotten his message and then destroyed her room.
Yeah.
And yes. I didn't really...
Yeah, we did talk about that.
There's comeuppances that happen.
When I read comics, I've found that I don't take the time to look at the art. And I had to go back and reread the first bit of this because I wanted to revisit it. And there was a moment where she reads the letter, and then there's a knock on the door, and there's someone saying, "Mademoiselle, you okay?" And I'm like, "Well, that's kind of interesting. What's that all about?" And then, but it's a wide shot, and everything in the room is destroyed. I'm like, oh, something happened here.
Right.
It was called Tulip's Rage.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yes. Any other words on Preacher?
I'm a little surprised this is only the first 26 issues. It feels like it's been longer.
Yeah.
Yeah, much longer.
Yeah, I looked at my shelf, and I've got the hard covers, not the death covers that you have. And, you know, we're only through book two of the current printing. So it's pretty interesting because I am still, like, rereading Cassidy stuff was just, like, I didn't remember his origin story, you know, again, because it's like fresh again, where I find myself being like, what's going to happen next, you right. know, like.
And I do love how casual it is. Just bog vampire.
Yep, yeah. Just yep. Take a quick bite. Just like, never saw it again. Doodly-doo.
Yeah. Yeah. And remember the context of when this story came out, and we were just mired in Anne Rice vampire elegance and goth culture and ruffled shirts and long hair and tragic browbeating, and then you know, to have this working class vampire, kind of it makes you ask why is he here, what is he doing? This guy lives forever and all he does is party, and he's not bored with it yet. That's what's amazing.
Well, he's only like 90 something. Wait till he gets like 200, then maybe he might get tired
he's
of
no
partying.
He's no Lestat, you know. But it's a different take on the vampire thing, sure. And I find him very refreshing.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
I also like them having their little heart to heart, where they can be kind of vulnerable with each other in their friendship, but also have their sort of like bro masculine like machismo thing. So I feel like it just gives you enough depth, so it doesn't like over bro me.
Yeah,
you know, I know that these two people care about each other and they're on this adventure together. So that's good for me,
because you're into friend stories.
I love friendship. I love friendship so much.
And this book is so chock full of friendship.
It's just, there's so much friendship.
And the stumbling blocks that comes of being someone's friend.
There's blasphemy and friendship. Those are things you can definitely count on in Preacher.
Yep. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yep.
All right, cool. Preacher, the Proud American Story Arc. Okay, thank you, everybody. And that is Book Apart. That is our show. Coming up is quiz time. But before we go, I want to tell you that the Perfect Bound podcast is brought to you by The Panel Jumper. See everything Cole Hornaday and I do at thepaneljumper.com, as well as Comics Dungeon here at 319 Northeast 45th Street in beautiful downtown Wallingford, or 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at comicsdungeon.com. Subscribe to the show on iTunes or however you get your podcast at perfectboundpodcast.com. Send us an email, perfectboundpodcast@gmail.com. And now, friends, get your quiz hats on. It's quiz time. This week, our questions come to us from Mr. Cole Hornaday. Laid on us,
and
Cole.
Of course, since we talked about Harlan Ellison earlier, what would this quiz time be devoted to but
Harlan Ellison?
That's right. This one is called "Here's to
Garth
You,
Ennis.
Garth Ennis." Anthony Bourdain.
No. "Here's to you, Mr. Ellison," or "Go angry into that good night, you nasty bastard."
That's pretty good.
Good. That's good.
Ellison was fearsomely protective of his intellectual properties and had no qualms about suing those he believed plagiarized his work, the most famous of which was a lawsuit around a teleplay he penned in 1964 for the Outer Limits episode entitled Soldier, based on a 1957 short story, Soldier from Tomorrow, about a grunt cast back in time. What 1984 blockbuster did Ellison claim stole his ideas?
Terminator.
Really? Ellison brought a lawsuit against production company Hemdale and distributor Orion Pictures for plagiarism of this episode. Since both works involve a soldier from the future who goes back in time and saves the life of a present-day woman from an enemy soldier from the future. Now, according to the Los Angeles Times, the parties settled the lawsuit for an undisclosed amount and an acknowledgement of Ellison's work in the credits of the Terminator. So that's one of the stipulations. Right. Now, here's an interesting sidebar I discovered when I was doing my research. About a year prior to this, Marvel writer Bill Mantlo blatantly lifted the story of Soldier, same story, for an Incredible Hulk story in number 286, retitling it Hero, and nowhere gave credit to Ellison or bothered to contact him for permission. Ellison saw the story because he reads comics, contacted Marvel's VP, and publisher Jim Shooter, and worked out an amicable deal. I'm doing air quotes, amicable deal, that included a lifetime subscription to Marvel titles. But this was the same story year before, and I think that Ellison threatened people on a regular basis with lawsuits. Yeah, yeah. So this had to have been Mantlo throwing somebody under a bus.
Oh.
You know, that's my suspicion. I will do research. Maybe there'll be a panel jumper here. Next, Ellison saw himself as anything but a science fiction writer, preferring to keep to a genre label far less particular. What area of fiction did he claim to dabble?
Science fantasy.
Horror?
Romance.
No. speculative fiction. An umbrella genre encompassing narrative fiction with supernatural and or futuristic elements that includes but not limited to science fiction, fantasy, superhero, science fantasy, horror, utopian, dystopian fiction, supernatural fiction, as well as combinations thereof. Or as Margaret Atwood describes it, a no Martians type of science fiction about things that could really happen.
It's a little pedantic.
It's Margaret Atwood.
No, I mean for him to be complaining about.
Yeah,
that.
Yeah. Well, and this is and here this just is Ellison in a nutshell. He said, "Call me a science fiction writer," Mr. Ellison said on Sci-Fi Channel now Sippy in the 90s. "I'll come to your house and nail your pet's head to a coffee table. I'll hit you so hard your ancestors will die." What a charmer. Next, Ellison frequently adopted the pseudonym Cordwainer Bird and gave it to work he wished to have no association. The moniker was a tribute to fellow science fiction writer Paul M.A. Linebarger, better known by his pen name Cordwainer Smith. Ellison once wrote a short story about his alter ego entitled The New York Review of Bird and enlisted Neil Adams to do the illustrations. In the tale, we discover Bird is the grandson of this dark detective with the power to cloud men's minds and knows, beyond all doubt, the evil that lurks in the hearts of men.
The Shadow.
The Shadow, right. Cordwainer Bird was a descendant of the Shadow. The illustrated version of the New York Review of Bird appeared in Strange Heroes, a new American pulp published by Pyramid Books in 1975.
You're going to have to show me how to spell Cordwainer.
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 Cordwainer. Cordwainer. It sounds, buddy.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Put that on a Starbucks cup.
In 1968, Ellison plotted the story of a two-part Avengers Hulk crossover wherein he swiped his own story title. The beast that shouted love at the heart of the world became the brute that shouted love at the heart of the atom. In this tale, old Jade Jaws has shrunk down to infinitesimal size and what may have been the first Marvel foray into the microverse. Can anyone name the miniature green alien princess with whom the Hulk fell in love?
Ja-la-la-la-la.
You're close. You're really close. Jarella. That's right, Chris. Thank you. Jarella, princess of the subatomic world, K'air. Hulk found himself in Jarella's world in The Incredible Hulk number 140. Lastly, adapted from Ellison's novella into a feature film, A Boy and His Dog featured an early performance by this future Miami Vice star.
Don Johnson?
Don Johnson. Released in 1975. The film A Boy and His Dog, directed by L.Q. Jones, was far from a commercial success, but eventually attained cult status and sees regular screenings on college campuses and dark, moist places where hipsters fear to tread.
Oh, jeez.
And that is quiz time. Thank you for indulging.
Jarella. Thank you, Cole. And thank you for listening. And we will see you next week.